In the book of Proverbs, in our Bible, Israel sings the praises of wisdom. In a number of these hymns, wisdom is personalized, made to seem as if it were flesh and blood. At one point, a very strange request is put into the mouth of wisdom. Tana b'ni libchali. O my son, give me your heart. We normally associate wisdom and the head, intelligence, the mind. But the Bible again and again equates wisdom in the heart, as if to underscore the thought that the heart has reasons of which reason is unaware. In our tradition, there's a keen awareness that the basic decisions of our lives are made by the heart, by our souls, not by the rational categories of logic. Hillel said it for all of us when he observed 2,000 years ago, "The place that my heart loves, there my feet lead me." And each of us could write chapter and verse from our own personal history. I should like to speak to you this evening heart to heart in terms of emotional response, in terms of our awareness, our sensitivity to the surge and sweep of life out there and in here. I'd like you to judge what I have to say, not by the sophistry of my argument, but by its significance. I'd like to see if we can break through the mask of words, the blanket of vocabulary with which we surround feeling, with which we imprison our response to life, which we use as justifications and rationalizations. Not to dare, not to care. Indeed, when our prophets imagined a gracious and gentle future, they spoke of it not only in terms of golden cities and happy places, but as a time in which God would give us a lev chadash, a new heart, no longer the lev ha'evan, no longer the heart of stone, the lev basar, a heart of flesh, of blood, a heart of feeling. Tana b'ni libcha li. Tonight, my friends, on this our holiest moment, lend me for a moment not your ears, but your heart. And listen with your heart to a story and to the day and to this holiness, to the great world that is ours, into the mystery that is life, into the fear that is life, and to the confusion that is life, into the hope that is life. But listen first with your heart to a story. It was told first by a Hasid some two centuries ago. His name was Hanoch. And he told of a very stupid man. A man who was so stupid that when he went to bed at night and he awakened in the morning, he could not remember where all his clothes were placed. And so paralyzed was he by this inability to get dressed in the morning that he was afraid to go to bed at night. And finally, by dint of great mental energy, he arrived on a scheme. And you know what he did. He made a list. He took paper and pencil, and as he got undressed at night, he wrote shoes under the bed, socks on top of the dresser. And sure enough, when he woke up the next morning, there was his list, and there were the shoes under the bed, and there were the socks on his dresser. And he happily and very pleasurably got dressed. And when he was all dressed up, he found that he couldn't move. He was still paralyzed. And Hanoch tells us what went through this foolish man's head. I'm all dressed up. I found all my clothes. But now, where am I? Where in the world am I? And that ends this story. Except for Hanoch's observation, where in the world are we? We don't like this comparison between ourselves and a stupid man, but I suggest that there is more truth to it than we might tend at first glance to acknowledge. We too have made lists. We call our list research. We call our list science. We have observed the world. We have observed the natural phenomena. And we have used these lists to give us some control over the world, to ameliorate the human condition. And so modern man's all dressed up, very expensively, though not always neatly. Where is he? Why did he get dressed up? Where's he going? Where in the world am I? Where in the world am I? I used to believe that I knew where I was. The goals were very clear. I was on my way to school, to graduate school, to a profession, to life. But really, where in the world am I? Where in the world are any of us? Do we know? Are we sure? Some of us are very sure. We carry around with ourselves very nice little boxes in which we have very neat little philosophies. We believe in family responsibility. We believe in financial security. We believe in rectitude and honor. We believe in a modicum of charity and of civic concern. And thank you very much, we're doing quite well. We're living up to each of these categories. But I wonder if we can be quite that sure and that confident that we know where we are and that we know where we're going, that we're so sure we're walking straight ahead on the right way, that we're not going backwards or circling purposely in an endless cul-de-sac. Most of these neat little philosophies that some of us carry around with ourselves are very good for us and for those who are exactly like us. But we live in an age of dissent. And whatever we think about a particular dissent, a particular act or a particular demonstration, certainly all of us, except the most obdurate among us, are confident that we can no longer be confident. We've had it pointed out to us how much emotional carnage is wrapped in some family in the names of family responsibility. And who among us is not convinced that financial security for one may be abuse of another? Our philosophy may really be nothing more than pretension. And what we conceive to be virtue may be, in fact, vanity, empty of all meaning and purpose. Where in the world am I? There's a great big world out there. It's strident, it's turbulent. Perhaps it's absurd, but sometimes certainly violent. And do these self-assured little truisms we carry around with ourselves, which we call our philosophy, are they really equal to the needs of understanding that surging, sweeping phenomena, which is reality? Oh yes, it's sufficient if we tame life, we call it by a word, life, we defang it, we housebreak it, but that's not what life really is it? Where in the world am I? Let me give you another image. Each of us is climbing through life on his own ladder. We've set our goals, we've set our hopes, and we're climbing high. But ultimately, what's the real question as to whether we're going to climb high and safely? Whether the ladder is securely resting on secure foundations, whether it's set in cement or concrete, which will hold it fast. And many of us start climbing before we're sure of the foundations. And then when we get up several rungs and we're suddenly buffeted by a cruel, unexpected blast of cold wind, we find that we're paralyzed. And in our fear and trembling, we pull the ladder down on top of ourselves and destroy ourselves. Life is full of risks. But at least let's not climb the ladder in false confidence, with a sense of assurance, which life itself cannot give us. Assuming that this neat little plot of land we call home, this neat little piece of existence which we call our own, has high walls which keep out all the unwanted clamor, all the unwanted people, all the unwanted weather, all the confusion and the turbulence and the violence. So what I'd like to do this evening, when we're talking not mind to mind but heart to heart, is to take a walk with you on the wild side into reality, into the whirlwind, into the storm, to raise questions which have no answers but which must be asked, to ask questions which we cannot answer with assurance but which we must somehow answer. And where should we begin? Let's begin right here. This is Yom Kippur. This is our synagogue. Our thoughts are with our people. Let's begin with our people and with its history. And let's begin by remembering not the shining faces of our children and our grandchildren, which we left at home after our last Yom Kippur meal, but let's look for a moment at 6 million ghosts. Men, women, and children who might very well be worshiping here with us this evening, but who cannot and never will. They were methodically butchered. And let's ask ourselves what these ghosts say to us about that pleasure some of us derive from the little courtesies and the little welcomes that are given to us by the so-called people of goodwill, whose governments did not enlarge their quotas, whose planes did not bomb the tracks to the death camps, whose foreign ministries and foreign offices suppressed the news of genocide. Let's ask ourselves, as we look in the face of these ghosts, whether we are really doing our children a favor when we talk to them of nice people, the dignity and the decency of human nature, when we forget how easy it was for those good German bureaucrats who had been organizing the traffic of foodstuffs, machine goods, change over and to move the paper which organized the traffic of human beings to their death. Who cared? Who cares? That's one question we must face tonight. Since this is a day of faith, let's ask the questions which are raised against faith when we walk on the wild side. We say our words of tradition rather glibly, most of us, most of the time. We speak them because they are written here in the book. We speak them because we are confident that whatever our little failings and errors during the past year, they were not that significant. God will forgive. We will have atonement. We will be at one again with God. But let's look at these ghosts. And let's remember how they said these prayers during those 5-6 Yom Kippurs in the concentration camps. What did they think? What did they feel? What did they mean when they said, Chatanu, we have sinned. Avinu, we have transgressed. Hashanah, we have done perversely. Could they really believe that whatever their private failings, it merited the monstrous tragedy in which they were caught? What did they think as they said, and they spoke of God as the one who controls life and decides when death shall come? Mi yamutu, mi yichyeh. Was it God? Or some subordinate of the camp commander? And what did they think as they pleaded with God? Shema kolenu, hear our prayer. Chus v'rachem aleinu, have mercy and have compassion upon us. When they beat their fists hopelessly against the heavens, and the heavens were unyielding, and God was silent. What was in those prayers? What feeling? What reality? Do we respond to that reality? Or do we take all of this as a rather simple performance, perfunctory, ceremonial? They died for their faith. How many of us can live for our faith? Which is the easier? One who somehow survived the concentration camps, Elie Wiesel, has created much of the ethos of the camp and some of his legends, and one deserves being told in this night when we are trying to break through the layers of convention and of comfort, to feel, to respond to life as it is. He tells the story of a 40-ish-year-old Rosh Yeshiva, a scholar who had been head of a Talmudic academy. He had been condemned to Auschwitz, to one of the labor gangs. He had been there for some months. His health was now broken. His strength was now quickly ebbing from him. The time would soon approach when he would be useless as a laborer, and he would be enrolled in one of the lists to be sent on to Dachau, to the death camp. It's the day before Yom Kippur. And suddenly he breaks the silence which is ordered, and he turns to the partner of his in the chain gang, and he says, I've made a decision. I'm not going to fast. And his partner, who's a simple man, responds, I think that's a wise decision. We will survive only as long as we have strength, and we need food to remain strong. Certainly God doesn't want us to hasten our death. I don't think he would be displeased. And the Rosh Yeshiva, the scholar, says to him, you don't understand at all. I've been without food many days, and I can be without food for another day. That's not the issue. All this time now that I've been in the camp, I had faith that God knew what he was doing. And now I no longer believe that. If he knows what he's doing, it's serious. And if he doesn't know what he's doing, it's more serious yet. I'm not going to fast. Night came, and the next morning, and the men were sent out, of course, to work. And late in the afternoon, again, the Rosh Yeshiva broke his silence, and he said, I have a confession to make. I fasted. There was no answer. And he said, I didn't fast for the reason that everyone else fasted. I kept remembering those days before the war when on Yom Kippur, those who wanted to mock God and to shout in anger against him would go to some cafe in the center of the city and there publicly on Yom Kippur order a meal. But here in the camp, the only way we can show our anger with God is not by denying his observance, but by observing it. Therefore, I fast. Now, whether we deny or we affirm, whether we rail in anger or accept passionately and lovingly, at least here there is feeling, here there is honesty, here there is a response to life. How it throws into shoddy relief our own calculation, our cold-heartedness, our unwillingness to face life as it is and to make some basic, fundamental, integral response to it. How in this bleeding, tearful, crying world can any of us continue to live with all the smug assurance of comfortable convinced people. What shall we say? How can we respond? On the level of intelligence, on the level of the intellect, rather, on the level of the categories of pure reason, there is no response. If you face the absurdity of Auschwitz, if you face the cruelty of the Holocaust, there is no intellectual explanation that you can give which justifies God or which establishes the presence of justice in our world. What response can we make to it? A theologian not so long ago said that God died at Auschwitz. He was very wrong. God did not die at Auschwitz. If anything, he became more powerful. Powerful to the point that he was frightening and fearsome and perhaps monstrous. If anything, God became at Auschwitz what he had seemed to be to primitive man. The all-powerful being who is utterly indifferent to human need and to human destiny. I remember one who survived one of the camps. Tess said to me once, God did not die at Auschwitz, but I wish he had. What response can we make? Can we justify God? Can we justify man? But most crucially, can we justify ourselves? The answer which we must make, the stance which we must take, is a stance of faith, feeling, care, bravery, moral, spiritual courage. And I use this word faith deliberately. The ancients were reasonable people. They knew the sudden advent of the storm. They knew how their ranks were decimated by the plague. They knew that they were powerless before 101 terrors of nature and of man, and it is utterly logical to conceive of the great power, to label it God, and to think of God as fearsome, as awful, as frightening, that our only response to God can be one of fear and trembling. And if our ancestors somehow came to the faith that they did come to, and assumed that God was not malevolent but benevolent, there was a universe that cared, that in that great mystery which surrounds us, there is not only the darkness, but divinity. If Moses and Jeremiah came to this conviction, they did not come to it out of reason, but in faith. They somehow looked into the storm, and they saw something there that seemed significant. They looked into the horror, and they saw the holy. They looked into tragedy and they saw majesty. What gave them that strength to see? We do not know. What gives us the strength to carry on? Will, courage, determination, doggedness. I will not be beaten to my knees. I will not be craven. I will not be cowardly. What is it? Ego? Courage? Faith, label it what you will. It's a response to life. If modern man has any prototype, my friends, it's Job. But Job, like the modern man, could not deny the existence of evil. Job had been beaten and he had been bruised. And Job knew that all the rationalizations and all the conversation of his comforters was irrelevant. Worrisome, bothersome. We've all suffered personal pain, grief, the loss of someone we loved. And we all remember how those words so well meant didn't really hit the mark. At least he was spared the indignity of paralysis. He would not have wanted to live his days without being whole and complete. And those words really didn't help. They covered over, they band-aided an issue without getting down to the reality, to the death and to the loss and to the loneliness, to the hurt and to the fear. And so it was with Job. And so I submit is it with us. All the theologians and all the philosophizing which has been given to us to justify the Holocaust, to justify this, the death of the 6 million, to justify all the violence and all the indignity and all the cruelty of our world, misses the mark. Like Job, we cannot be satisfied intellectually. But Job somehow held on. There's something in man which will not give in, which will not cave in, which will not become craven. Job was told by his wife, curse God and die. Job was told by his friends, if you don't accept our justification, there is no justification. Yet Job held on to his integrity. And so somehow have we, so somehow must we. We must hold on. And then you remember the story of Job? God spoke to Job out of the whirlwind. God spoke to Job out of the mystery. And God did not excuse his actions. God did not justify what he had done to him. I only wanted to test you, Job. I didn't really mean it. God did not speak of the tragedy. He simply spoke of his majesty. He did not speak specifically of man. He spoke of creation. He spoke of ultimate things. And somehow Job came to understand the divinity, which is somehow wrapped up with the darkness, which is itself the mystery, all about. Well, can we find, as Job found, this faith? To do so, we must care. We must care enough to dare. To dare to expose ourselves to the world as it is. To dare to accept a description of life which is far from comforting and far from comfortable. To dare to look on faith for answers where there are no answers, to deny ourselves a faith which gives us false security. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I shall fear no evil, for thou art with me. Until I walk through the valley of the shadow and I come suddenly stark up against the brick wall of the gas oven, and there is no place to turn. There is no place to go. One who is willing to expose himself to life as it is, one who is willing not only to reason about business and security and advancement and achievement and his status and place in society, but one who is willing to respond to life in the raw, to feel, to care, such a man, I think, will come as I have come. Realize that beyond the mental confusion, there is offered to us, through our heart, a sense that the universe does have a heart. That somehow, despite all the darkness, and all the redness of hurt and pain, despite it all, there is purpose, and there is hope. There is a majesty which outweighs the tragedy. I've come more and more to believe in an old Kabbalistic observation of our people. The Messiah will come the darkest midnight of our history. Strange, and intellectually not satisfying, but perhaps spiritually so. It's strange that whenever Israel has suffered, Israel had been renewed. When our people were driven off into Babylonian exile, the diaspora began. We not only were concentrated now in one place, but in many places, and we drew great understanding and great meaning from exposure to many cultures, and the homeland and the diaspora strengthened one another. And when Rome came and Judea was crushed under the iron boot, The temple was destroyed, the synagogue came to its own, and now our faith had not just one place, but many places. It had a new start in freedom, in learning, and in spirit. And when the Inquisition came and put the screws and the torch to our people, demanded that they accept a faith which they had no desire to accept, we found the Kol Nidre, the great hymn of loyalty to faith, which has summoned us as it summoned us tonight to come again and to be renewed. And when the Cossacks under Khmelnytsky in the 17th century swept across Europe and killed, as did Hitler in his day, 1 in 3, we found a new source of joy in our faith. We found Hasidism. And from Auschwitz, there is Israel. Does it satisfy the mind? Does not. Does it justify the dead? It does not. Can it be a response? Faith? It can. Where in the world am I? I am in the tradition of my people. And I will not give the victory to the enemy. He sought our death. I seek our life. Where in the world am I? I stand with those who are faithful to the image of civilization, who will give justice and freedom a try, die in the effort. Where in the world am I? I am in the synagogue, on the holiest night of our year, and I seek to give my heart to God. Amen.